From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. President Biden is ramping up efforts to get more Americans vaccinated. An administration official tells NPR the FDA is likely to authorize the use of the Pfizer vaccine for 12 to 15-year-olds in the next week. And today, President Biden is targeting rural areas where health experts are raising the alarm, not about access, there are vaccines available, but about the rate of vaccination, even among healthcare workers in hospitals. And NPR has exclusive reporting that doctors will play a big role in Biden's plan. Earlier today, we spoke with NPR's White House correspondent Tamara Keith, and I asked her what's going on in rural hospitals that's been so concerning to health officials.
This is a survey conducted by the National Rural Health Association. And what they found, they reached out to CEOs at rural hospitals. And of those who responded, 30% said that less than half of their employees had chosen to get a vaccine for the coronavirus. And that is a very low share of a population that should be universally vaccinated by this point in terms of availability. I mean, hospital staff have been able to get vaccinated, especially the frontline medical workers, since December or January at the latest.
Well, do officials know why this is happening?
It's a combination of things. Some of the very same issues that are leading people in the general population to be hesitant or delay getting vaccinated. Hospital administrators say that some of their staff still have questions or concerns, and that it is reflective of the broader communities in these rural areas, where other polling indicates that there are a greater share of people who say they simply will not get the vaccine. Breaking through that is going to be a critical part of reaching a broader vaccination in the community, which the Biden administration is working on. And, you know, I did talk to one hospital in New Hampshire that's had decent luck getting staff to get vaccinated. And they said that their success in part was because an influential doctor at the hospital sent a note early on and said, hey, here's what we know, and I think you should do it. I'm going to do it. I'm looking forward to getting my vaccine. And apparently that persuaded a lot of people. They also did Zoom calls to answer questions, having doctors answer questions. The lesson from that is that doctors and nurses are influential in their communities, both within the hospital system and out more broadly in the community, which is why health officials and the Biden administration have put such an emphasis on these trusted deliverers of the message. But at the same time, there are alarm bells in this survey from rural hospital chiefs.
Well, so, you know, the hospital chiefs were alarmed because their staff wasn't getting vaccinated. We should say, you know, there are relatively good rates of vaccination in rural areas. It just, you know, needs to be bumped up. And so the plan is to take advantage of that finding that people trust their doctors. What is President Biden going to announce?
Yeah, so what President Biden is announcing, we've learned from an administration official, is that the administration is working with states to make sure vaccines get to primary care providers, to doctors' offices, to these familiar, trusted spaces. And the Biden administration is targeting this to areas with a high vulnerability index score that includes rural communities, some urban communities as well. And one important thing is they are working with family physicians and pediatricians to get them to sign up to get vaccines in their offices in anticipation of the likely authorization for use of the Pfizer vaccine in adolescents 12 to 15, which would be a growth area for vaccination.
Boy, Tam, I think a lot of people listening are saying, God, I would have liked my doctor to be the one to give me a shot instead of some of the mass vaccination sites. So we'll see how this goes.
Yeah, this is the next phase. This is the personal conversation phase, getting past the people that were super excited and would go anywhere and walk over broken glass to get a vaccine. And now to people who want to have a conversation with someone they trust.
Right. Tamara Keith, NPR's White House correspondent. By the way, Tam, are you there in the White House correspondent area in the White House?
I am currently actually at Joint Base Andrews awaiting a flight with the vice president.
Excellent. Well, we look forward to your reporting. Tam, thank you.
You're welcome.
There's a water crisis in Jackson, Mississippi. We first heard about it over the winter when freezing storms wreaked havoc on the city's crumbling infrastructure, leaving residents there without running water for an entire month. On top of that, a significant percentage of Jackson residents are now going into debt, trying to pay overdue bills, while others are in a complicated loop of disputing unusually high bills. One of the problems is that for years, Jackson used an antiquated billing system that made water meter usage difficult to track. Here's Jackson native Nashambi Lambright.
So they're still straightening those water bills out because there are still citizens that had $1,000 water bills and, you know, are just attempting to rectify that by saying, okay, we know that you need to pay something, but of course it's not $1,000.
This problem, says Lambright, is now compounded by the state of Mississippi's demands that the city of Jackson collect overdue water bills before it allocates money to help the city repair its crumbling infrastructure. I spoke with Nashambi Lambright, who is the executive director of One Voice, about how all of this is impacting Jackson residents, along with Dominica Perry, a climate economist and founder of 2C Mississippi, a nonprofit climate change action group. I started off our conversation by asking Perry how climate change is worsening these problems for Jackson.
The city of Jackson is not getting any richer. The population in the city of Jackson is shrinking. Income is going down, and that provides less and less buffer against those climate exacerbated problems. When water crisis happened, people who had resources moved outside of the city limit to hotels. People who don't have those resources have to stay. And that is a general story. Vulnerable populations are affected by all problems with much deeper intensity just because they are not set up to be resilient based on resources and rights.
Nashambi, you've lived in Jackson your whole life. How do these problems with climate change add to the burden of these infrastructure problems? How do those impact daily life there? Have you felt it get worse over the years?
I have. The climate infrastructure absolutely tells the story because I never saw as much flooding as I do now when I was growing up. Neighborhoods that are completely flooded and washed out when a huge storm comes in. You would see that maybe once every 10 years, and now it seems like it's every month.
Last month, there was this bill to allow Jackson to raise its citywide sales tax by 1% for water and sewer system repairs. And it was killed in the final days of the legislative session. Dominica, how do you think President Biden's infrastructure plan might impact Jackson and this effort to really fix its crumbling infrastructure?
I have great hopes for federal support for the city of Jackson. I hope that the focused interest on infrastructure and specifically on infrastructural investments that are climate resilient is going to bring a completely different era to Jackson and cities like Jackson.
Nashambi, are you frustrated by state legislators? It just seems like there is a contentious relationship between the city of Jackson and this understanding of the challenges that people are facing in the day to day.
Legislators don't get that a strong capital city benefits the entire state, that hurting Jackson hurts the entire state.
Back in 2014, the United Nations reiterated its stance that water is a human right. And this was after activists in the city of Detroit actually called for the water department to stop water shutoffs. It was very similar to what you're dealing with in Jackson. What do you want to hear as part of the larger discourse around access to clean water in this nation specifically? And I'll start with you, Dominica.
Well, I'm incredibly frustrated that in the United States, we deal with issues that should be resolved given the level of income of our nation. We should not have boiling water notices in a capital city in the United States. We should not have women getting nervous over putting their children in a bath because the bath is filled with filthy brown water. These issues need to obviously be addressed as soon as possible. And this crisis, I'm really hoping, is going to bring this to the front line of discussions about what is acceptable and what is not acceptable.
Nishambi.
These problems didn't just start over the past few years. We've been dealing with the crumbling infrastructure for at least the past 30 years, probably longer than that. And, you know, it's going to take an overwhelming amount of support to completely overhaul our water system. And so I'm hoping that with the new administration in the White House and the president's commitment to supporting infrastructure nationwide, that we'll get some support here.
That's Nishambi Lambright. She's a native of Jackson and executive director of One Voice. And Dominica Perry, she's a climate economist and founder of 2C Mississippi, a nonprofit climate change action group. Thank you both for your time.
Thank you.
In India today, the number of COVID-19 cases has surpassed 20 million, making India only the second country in the world after the U.S. to reach that milestone. The situation in many parts of the country is so dire, one guest told us a few days ago that the entire country is like a war zone. Joining us now is Mahesh Langa, a senior assistant editor at The Hindu, joining us from the city of Ahmedabad in the western state of Gujarat. Welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you very much.
Mahesh, please describe the situation where you are.
Well, you know, the situation is pretty bad. It's a catastrophe that we are witnessing. In terms of deaths, it's a devastation. Hundreds of deaths, thousands of new cases. Hospitals are full. There is short supply of oxygen. People are literally dying without oxygen in countryside, in rural areas, and even in big towns and big cities. Crematoria are working round the clock. So it's a very, very, it's a catastrophe that India is going through right now.
Mahesh, we're also reading that vaccines have been suspended for people over the age of 45 because of a shortage. Can you tell us about that?
Yes. So what has happened, you know, that the way India launched its vaccination drive, it's been pretty slow. So far, vaccination drive was launched way back in January. We are yet to hear anything from the government about, you know, authorization to other vaccine candidates like Pfizer, Moderna and others. So, you know, India needs plenty of vaccines and unfortunately, there are no vaccines. So cities have suspended vaccination for people above 45, for people above 60. And now, you know, there is literally scramble for vaccine and there are no vaccine shots available.
And then, as you mentioned, there's the situation at area hospitals. These stories are absolutely horrifying. People are waiting outside of hospitals where there are no longer any beds or even oxygen. Can you give us some examples of what you're seeing where you are?
Situation is horrible to say the least, because it's Ahmedabad is one of the largest cities in the country with population of almost 7 million. You won't get even a normal bed in any hospital, either the public hospital or the private hospital anywhere in the city. I have, you know, very good friend who has died outside the hospital because there was a huge queue for patients to be admitted and he died on the stretcher. Almost 90 patients were in the queue to be admitted. And by the time his turn came, he had gone. So it's a very, very bad situation. We have no ICU beds. We have no normal beds. And, you know, in the city, we are witnessing almost 100 deaths per day.
Mahesh, you pointed out to us that the majority of cases that we're hearing about are in big cities, but you're concerned about those in the countryside.
The kind of reports that we get from the language press, from the regional press, is horrifying. People are dying in the villages without even getting tested because we have testing centers at the district level. Whereas, you know, some villages are almost 100 kilometers away from the district center. So they do not even have a mechanism to go themselves to get themselves tested. So it's a pretty horrifying situation. We have been seeing, you know, regional papers running, you know, 5-page, 6-page condolence messages and obituaries. It's a devastation probably much more than what is in countryside than what is happening in the urban centers.
Let's talk about help right now. About 15 countries, including the U.S., are stepping in to rush critical emergency equipment to these hospitals. Stepping out to look at the bigger picture, what is needed right now? What does India need to get through this?
What India needed right now is to build, makeshift, temporary hospital beds so that people can at least be admitted and taken care of. What is happening right now is that, this second wave has hit in such a severe manner that the country's health infrastructure has already become overwhelmed.
Are those your children behind you, Mahesh, that we're hearing?
Yes, we have two babies, one six-year-old and one is just two-year-old boy.
So you're managing all of this while also trying to keep your family safe.
Oh, yes. I'm the only one who go out from the house to buy some essentials or, for my work. So my wife manages my two kids and I kind of sleep in a separate room. I keep wearing mask at home. So my interaction with kids and my wife is quite limited. And that's the way we are trying to manage the situation. We have booked in the government portal, but we are yet to get the slot for vaccination.
Mahesh Lenga is a senior assistant editor at The Hindu from the city of Ahmedabad in the western Indian state of Gujarat. Mahesh, I really appreciate you taking the time to share with us what is a grim situation in India. My best to you and your family. Thank you so much, and here's to relief coming very soon.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
A scientific research vessel is about to set sail on the Atlantic Ocean. It's an autonomous robot designed to gather climate and other data. Artificial intelligence experts say it's a boon for science, but some people are questioning the name of the ship. From IEEE Spectrum, Ari Daniel has our story.
Last fall, on September 16th, 400 years to the day that the original Mayflower set off, a new kind of ship was launched in Plymouth, England.
And if any of you are in doubt, she was christened with Plymouth gin.
The ship is also called the Mayflower, says Brett Faniff, but that's where the similarities stop.
It looks like sort of an Imperial cruiser shuttlecraft spaceship-looking thing.
It's a 50-foot trimaran, so three hulls.
So it's very long and slender, and it moves through the water very efficiently.
But there are no people aboard, and no doors and no windows. That's because this new Mayflower is autonomous, meaning it pilots and plots itself, using artificial intelligence, or AI. Faniff directs the Mayflower Autonomous Ship Project, which is led by a nonprofit called Promare. IBM is the lead tech and science partner.
When it's sailing across the ocean, it'll look at the weather. It looks at, is there land? Is it too shallow? Is there a tanker crossing my path? It has to fuse all that into a common understanding of the scene and then decide how to maneuver.
The vessel will also collect climate and weather data from the sea and sky. Faniff envisions an eventual network of autonomous systems, vessels like this one, but also satellites in orbit and smaller underwater robotic gliders that coordinate, filter, and process their data about ocean health using AI before handing it off to scientists. The Mayflower is powered by a combination of solar, lithium batteries, and a little diesel. It's even got a sail for when there's good wind. Later this month, the vessel will travel from Plymouth, England to Plymouth, Massachusetts, a three-week voyage with the aim of zero human involvement.
The goal is not to replace people at sea. The goal is to drive the cost down to collect massive amounts of data that then helps us better target where we send people to go and do the most meaningful research.
I think it's extremely ambitious.
Mitali Nkonde is executive director of AI for the People and a fellow at the Stanford Center on Philanthropy and Civil Society.
When you have human beings on these ships, you also have discernment and judgment. Whereas AI systems are going to have to be way more sophisticated in terms of how they learn and the types of decisions and judgments that they can make.
And Kunde sees applications to the autonomous vehicle space as well, but she worries about the ship's name.
The Mayflower is going to invoke all of these feelings of like patriotism and optimism and hope, but only if you're white. Everything that we develop sits in the context of a racialized past.
For the Wampanoag, there is a whole other meaning to Mayflower, something that is symbolic of colonization.
Sonk Waban, or Paula Peters, is a member of the Wampanoag tribe, the indigenous community whose ancestors lived in Patuxet, now known as Plymouth, before the Pilgrims arrived. She's a writer and historian, and she gets the thinking behind the name Mayflower.
They're trying to make that same voyage, only this time without the passengers, really with technology.
But she says it's important to reckon with the baggage that comes with that name, the loss of life and liberty for indigenous peoples.
That backstory is so critical. So, no, it doesn't offend me. Essentially, party on with your Mayflower. But I'm going to speak out. Here's the impact that it had on my ancestors.
Brett Faniff welcomes this conversation.
I think it's a good opportunity to talk about it in a different context. Maybe it's a time we had a Mayflower that we could universally accept as something good that didn't invoke colonialism, but invoked our common future.
When the new Mayflower finally does come ashore in the U.S. in June, it'll have navigated the open ocean by itself, a somewhat easier task, perhaps, than navigating the complexities of the humans waiting to receive it. For Here and Now, I'm Ari Daniel.
A few years ago, a website popped up in Stockton, California, and conspiracy theories started ramping way up.
And it's being funded by conservative movement underneath the table.
And I was like, oh my gosh, you guys, people really believe this.
What happens when the local news outlet isn't fact-checking conspiracy theories? Maybe encouraging them? Listen now from NPR's Invisibilia podcast.
The Biden administration has just finished a lengthy review of U.S. policy toward North Korea. The watchwords, a calibrated, practical approach, according to Secretary of State Antony Blinken. Now, as we hear from NPR's Michelle Kellerman, the U.S. is waiting to see what North Korea's approach will be.
North Korea's nuclear program has been one of the thorniest issues for U.S. foreign policymakers in recent decades. Secretary Blinken puts it this way.
This is an incredibly hard problem, and to state the obvious, it is yet to be solved from administration to administration, Democrat and Republican.
The Biden administration consulted every U.S. official involved in past diplomacy with North Korea. Blinken has also been talking to U.S. allies to make sure everyone's on the same page. Now he's hoping North Korea will see this as an opportunity to engage.
What we have now is a policy that calls for a calibrated, practical approach that is open to and will explore diplomacy with North Korea to try to make practical progress that increases the security of the United States, our allies, and our deployed forces.
The Trump administration tried summit diplomacy with high-profile meetings in hopes of reaching a big, comprehensive deal. Joseph Yoon, who was U.S. Special Representative for North Korea until 2018, says the Biden team is moving away from that.
Some people call it step-by-step approach. Some people call it incremental approach. So essentially, the U.S. is giving up on immediate denuclearization, but hopefully diplomatic engagement can lead to an eventual denuclearization.
Biden officials have said little about what kind of deal they want, and Yoon points out that North Korea will have its say.
Everyone has a plan. That's what the boxer Mike Tyson said, until you get punched in the mouth, you know? And so we are now waiting to see whether North Korea will throw that punch or not.
Over the weekend, North Korea accused the U.S. of having a hostile policy because Biden, in a speech to Congress, described North Korea's nuclear program as a serious threat. Jean Lee, who runs the Korea program at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars, was surprised.
Biden's comments to Congress were so measured. I mean, he really didn't give the North Koreans that much to work with, to be honest. But the response was blistering.
And she fears it could be a sign of what's to come.
I do believe that Kim Jong-un does want to get back to the nuclear negotiations, but he has to come back to them in a stronger position. And unfortunately, the way that the North Koreans have done that in the past is to raise tensions.
Ambassador Yoon of the U.S. Institute of Peace is hoping North Korea won't do anything provocative while diplomats try to quietly probe what's possible. He thinks the U.S. should work along two tracks.
One track on denuclearization and second track on peace building or peace negotiations. I think that will go some ways to getting North Koreans to think, yes, this may indeed be a different game.
The Korean War ended in 1953 with an armistice, not a peace treaty. Working on that, Yoon says, could run in parallel to the thorny negotiations over North Korea's growing nuclear arsenal. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, Washington.
So how are you a year into a pandemic? Would you like to say something other than fine, but with people really suffering, you can't? Our next guest says maybe you should, for your own mental health. And he coined a word for you, languishing, not depression, not flourishing. As psychologist Adam Grant wrote in the New York Times, languishing is the neglected middle child of mental health. It can be serious, a warning. We'll talk about how it can lead to darker thoughts of suicide. But just languishing has really caught on. Emory University sociologist Corey Keyes joins us. You coined the word. Are you surprised it's caught on?
Yes, I was, in large part because I've been publishing on this research since 2002. Apparently, it took the pandemic and the shutdown of life as we knew it to bring greater attention to it.
Right. Well, what is languishing?
Well, languishing is, as you mentioned at the outset, it's not the presence of depression or sadness and hopelessness. It's the absence of feeling good about your life, that is either happy, satisfied, or interested in your life. But it's also the absence of meaning in your life, such as lacking purpose, belonging, a sense of contribution, and a sense of mastery or the ability to manage your life. So languishing is emptiness and stagnation.
Mm. But it's still hard to kind of figure out the difference between this indifference and depression.
Technically speaking, depression is a clinical disorder precisely when nothing in your life has changed that is of importance. And all of a sudden, you've gone from feeling interested in life to being sad, along with a variety of signs of malfunctioning, like you're sleeping too much or too little, and you were interested in life, and now you're thinking about suicide, among other things, and a sense of hopelessness. So depression is the presence of malfunctioning and the presence of sadness and hopelessness. Well, languishing is neither feeling good nor sad. It's feeling really nothing.
Yeah. Indifferent. Indifferent.
Yes. Yes. And I was going to say the French had a term for it. The existentialists called it ennui.
Yeah. It's funny you mentioned this, Professor, because I once had student friends who were in a student orchestra that played in New York, and they were getting a review in the New York Times, and the New York Times said they played with ennui, and I got so excited, I thought it was some famous violinist or something. Tell, what is ennui?
Well, ennui is, I think, the French version of languishing. It is indifference and emptiness. Throughout history, I mean, it goes way back. There used to be an eighth deadly sin called acedia, defined as a want of interest in life. This emptiness or lack of interest in life led people to distract themselves with, shall we say, unsavory things. So it got folded in to the sin called sloth. most cultures lost awareness of it.
So a want for an interest in life. Is this then the reason that this is not melancholy, you know, from the Victorian era, the sort of, you know, sorrowful, sad, I need a fainting bed? That sounds like more like depression, where you can feel sadness.
And I've been there myself, having suffered from depression. When you're feeling depressed, you don't really want to get out of bed. What happens with languishing is you get up, you go through the motions, you're ready for life. It's almost like you put yourself on hold and you're waiting for something good to happen, or you're even trying to distract yourself by jump-starting the good old battery that I call emotion, which is to feel something.
Yeah. Well, why is it so important for us to know about this word and these feelings and acknowledge them? I can hear someone saying, oh, get over yourselves. Look at the poor people in India. You know, this is an American privilege to consider your languishing with your back of your hand to your forehead. Why is it not that to you?
In part because my research has shown that the absence of things like mental disorders does not mean anything close to everyone flourishing or having good mental health. And those people who are in between, they're not flourishing, they're not mentally ill, they have a very high risk of suicide attempts. They have a very high risk of developing depression and anxiety. We've even shown that these people who are languishing have a very high risk of premature mortality. And that gets even more serious as we grow old.
Well, and so what do we do about it? Because there are things you can do. And Adam Grant wrote so beautifully about finding the flow, the thing that suddenly you're engaged with. And I started realizing, you know, Carpenter Ants are destroying my deck and I can't get to my yoga class, but I can go edit. And when I edit, you know, work with sound, I am engaged. I'm like, I feel it. I feel something happen. Is that what you and he mean by finding something that gives you that flow?
I have that hunch that I wasn't alone, where I started engaging throughout my home in projects and learning new things. And when I was at the hardware, I noticed there were a lot of other people taking on self and home improvement projects. And I thought that was a sign where people were doing what they could to do for themselves and engage and learn something new. It may not have caused flow for everyone, but I suspect it was an attempt.
Mm. Is just saying the word helpful? It's so serious in some cases. You know, there were studies that show that healthcare workers languishing last spring were 3 times as likely as their peers to have post-traumatic stress disorder.
Well, let me make a bit of a plea. We've been working on this domain to try to redirect the national attention on the problem of mental illness. My research has also shown that, you know, that mental health and mental illness belong to two distinct continua. And as I mentioned, that means the absence of mental illness does not mean everyone's flourishing. But another implication of it is that the things that we use to lower the bad, like depression or anxiety, do not necessarily elevate the good. Things like flourishing. Hmm. Cholesterol is a great example. When we have high levels of bad cholesterol, we take statins. And statins do a good job lowering bad levels of cholesterol. But they do not elevate levels of good cholesterol. And in order to get the best heart health outcomes, you need low levels of the bad and high levels of the good cholesterol. The World Health Organization's prediction that depression will be the number one cause of burden to every country on this planet will happen by 2030. Hmm. But that's a prediction that doesn't have to come true if we change the way we approach the problem of mental illness and stop trying to treat our way out of it.
And when you say treat our way out of it, you mean with medication and such? In other words, we need to find that engagement, that flow first.
Yes. Well, the usual response is, well, let's try more medications. Let's train more clinicians and psychiatrists, and let's provide more services. And there's nothing wrong with that. But no public health problem throughout history has ever been solved through individual treatment alone. What we've had to do is move upstream, look at the conditions under which we live and how they prevent mental illnesses or physical illnesses. And that requires reimagining the conditions of life. Mm. And mental disorders are not curable. They're chronic, unrelenting disorders. Believe me, I suffer from two of them. Mm. And nothing the medical doctors and all the king's men and women could do to put this Humpty Dumpty back together again.
You had to do it. You had to find the way to flourish.
Yes. Yeah. My own research has been my own personal search for my North Star, which is I want to flourish, because we've also shown in a paper we published about a year ago that if you've had a mental disorder and you have higher levels of good mental health, you're more likely to recover and to stay in recovery from mental disorders. So not only prevents, but it's something that also could be useful to people who have suffered from mental disorders, like myself and others.
That's Professor Corey Key, sociologist at Emory University, who coined the phrase languishing, which many people feel they are doing right now, just bleh. Indifference to your own indifference, as Adam Grant put it in the New York Times. Professor Keyes, thank you so much.
Well, thank you for having me, Robin.
And as always, if you're having darker thoughts of suicide, make that call. The suicide hotline is 800-273-8255.
Facebook is deciding the fate of former President Donald Trump, or at least the fate of his account, on the world's largest social network. The platform's new oversight board is expected to announce tomorrow whether Facebook must reinstate Trump's account after it was banned for inciting violence in the Capitol insurrection. It's the first case this board will decide, and it will have major implications for political leaders and online speech. Let's bring in Elizabeth Dwoskin. She is Silicon Valley correspondent for The Washington Post, and she has been following this story. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hey, Tanya.
So first, briefly remind us how we actually got here, what exactly the board is deciding tomorrow.
We got here because of the Capitol riots and the mob that stormed the Capitol and what Trump said in relation to that mob on that day. That day and in the subsequent days, all the social media platforms banned Trump in some shape or form, Twitter permanently, Facebook and YouTube indefinitely. And it was because of comments he made. In Facebook's case, it was a video in which he called his supporters patriots and very special. And in the case, and it was also a post where he told his supporters, "You should remember this day forever. And these are the things and events that happen when a landslide victory is so unceremoniously and viciously stripped away from patriots." So those were the posts,
Elizabeth,
that got him banned.
Yeah. Yes, those are the posts that got him banned, but there have been many instances of political figures using social media to push incendiary statements. So how did Trump become the test case here?
It's something that a lot of experts have pointed out, that Trump has repeatedly promoted misinformation. I think I put on, just on Facebook alone, a quarter of his posts were either misinformation or extreme rhetoric just in 2020. And so you could have almost picked any point, certainly during the George Floyd protests when he talked about looting and shooting. People thought that was incitement to violence. But Facebook has long had a very kind of tortured and kid gloves relationships with Trump, which I go into in my story today, which kind of explains why they've been very, very resistant to censoring him in any way.
Right. Well, if the board holds up this ban, it actually puts a lot of pressure on Facebook to really step up crackdowns on other online speech, doesn't it?
It does. If they permanently kick off Trump, it's almost like they're going to be setting a standard and saying this type of behavior was inexcusable. Now, here's the question. I think the million-dollar question is, which type of behavior? Is it the incitement of violence on a violent day? Or is it the whole schema of behavior, the whole way that he used social media to inflame his audience and create chaos in the country and divisiveness? And yes, as I spoke yesterday to a former executive at Facebook who worked in this area, who said day one, as soon as that decision comes down, which is tomorrow, they're going to be pummeled with thousands of questions about every other world leader who is bombastic, right, who is inflammatory.
Right. I mean, because also on the other hand, if his account is reinstated, that also sets the bar for being banned that much higher.
Yes. And I spoke to a free speech expert, Danielle Citron, yesterday, who said if they reinstate him, she believes they shouldn't. She said if they reinstate him, it's almost saying, well, a public figure can do absolutely anything and not really get in trouble. That's a strong position, but that is, you know, on some levels, she'll say, what would the bar be at all? There's no rules then for public figures.
Well, this board is made up of outside experts, but Facebook had actually a hand in picking them, and the board is actually paid for by Facebook. At this point, is it possible to say whether this experiment was a success, really whether other social media companies might adopt something similar?
I think we got to step back and say how bizarre this whole thing is. I mean, you have this private company, one of the richest companies in the world, that's essentially creating its own regulatory body. And everyone is covering it very seriously while we're in the midst of this political moment nationally and internationally where people are actually considering regulating this company. And they've said it's an experiment. And I think as a society, we have to see, is it successful? What does that success mean? Does it take the place of regulation? Is it a template for regulation if it's successful? For example, the Oversight Board has not just decided individual cases, but made a lot of recommendations, for example, about how algorithms need to be transparent processes. And that's something that you can actually see lawmakers adopting. So it's kind of a long-winded answer to your question, Tanya, but I actually think it's definitely too early. It's still a major experiment. And we have to, as a society, decide whether it's really enough. It's really for a private company basically picking its own umpire, you know, its own judges and paying for it. Yes, they're luminaries. Yes, they're independent. But it's still Facebook picking its own judges. It's not regulation.
That's Elizabeth Dwoskin, Silicon Valley correspondent for The Washington Post. As always, thank you so much.
Thanks, Tanya.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.